Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Over the past decade or so, much has been written about finding one's purpose in life. And for some, it's helping others. Others, it's building a business or raising a family or working to live. But for still others, it's identifying and working on a quest. And my guest, as in his previous books and in his life, has always found his own path. Chris Guillebeau is an entrepreneur and author of The Art of Nonconformity and The $100 Startup. His quest, which he recently achieved, was to visit every country in the world prior to his 35th birthday. During the course of his quest, he learned of many others doing the same type of thing. Some were athletic, like walking across America or bicycling around the world or running 250 marathons in a year. Others in active activism, like protesting illegal logging by sitting in a tree for a year or abstaining from motorized travel. Still others were explorations, like Tulsa's Sasha Martin, who prepared a meal once a week from every country in the world, or self-discovery, like Zha Zhang, who would practice something called rejection therapy, in which he would ask for a bold request from a stranger until someone turned him down. But all were finding some measure of purpose in these quests. Guillebeau has written about the link between questing and long-term happiness in his book, The Happiness of Pursuit, Finding the Quest That Will Bring Purpose to Your Life. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Chris Guillebeau, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Rich. Thanks so much for having me.
This new book, The Happiness Pursuit, first of all, you tell your own story of fulfilling a quest, but you also document a number of other people who found a sort of a single-minded task that they had to complete. So let's begin with what a quest is. What exactly is a quest, and how does it differ from a resolution, a goal, or a bucket list, or as you call it, a life list? I kind of like that name better than a bucket list.
Yeah, well, you know, as you mentioned, I spent about 10 and a half years going to every country in the world, and that was just a crazy idea I had, and I loved to travel, and I was also a goal setter. I liked making lists, and so I kind of put all these things together and came up with this quest, and the more I pursued it, the more I enjoyed it, and along the way, I started, you know, meeting up with other people who were also pursuing quests and big adventures, and wanted to learn from them and see kind of why they did that and what they learned along the way. And so the first part of the process was to figure out, okay, what exactly is a quest? Because we all have different things that we do. We have different hobbies, things that we enjoy. But if we pursue something like for a long period of time, is that a quest? So a quest is something that has a destination. It has a goal. It has something that you're working toward. It may ultimately be all about the process or the journey, but there is actually an end in sight. You know, there is that final country or whatever it is. It's something that usually involves a lot of milestones or stages or levels. You can kind of point to progress along the way. And there's also an element of challenge. So a good quest can't be too easy. It has to have some difficulty. It has to have something that must be overcome or something that must be won, some kind of battle or some kind of endurance. And a quest is also fun. You know, I actually really enjoyed my 10 years of traveling to every country in the world, and I found it very meaningful and very fulfilling.
Does it have to have an endpoint? Because I know some of the people you document, it's probably likely that they won't reach an endpoint. I'm thinking of the gentleman who's trying to create clean water for every community, and I think in Africa.
Mm.
That's something that may transcend a life.
Yeah, you know, it may transcend a life, but I think that gentleman, Scott Harrison with Charity Water, he's actually had a pretty huge impact. I think maybe his quest may expand, you know, like your vision tends to expand as you work towards something. But initially he was working with some communities in Ethiopia, and Ethiopia is not a small place. You know, there's millions of people there and the need was quite great. But I really do think, like, you know, over time he's actually going to be able to meet that need, at least in that community. And then, maybe like he'll have another quest. Maybe he'll go on. But I guess the idea is a quest is not just general life improvement. Like, we all do things. We want to take care of our health. We want to take better care of our finances. And those are good and valid things. But a quest is usually something a bit deeper, a bit broader, something that maybe takes more out of us.
And as your subtitle of the book suggests, it's finding something that will help bring purpose to your life. And I think from everyone you spoke with, at the beginning of their particular quest journey, there was a sense of discontent.
Yeah, I really like that word discontent, because discontent doesn't mean that you're miserable, doesn't mean that you're unhappy. You know, you can have a pretty good life, but you still feel this yearning for something more. You still feel this striving that there's something that you want to do. And maybe you have a crazy idea, like I had a crazy idea. Even if you don't have a crazy idea, like you just want to be part of something. You want your life to matter. You want your days to count. And so that's what discontent is. And a lot of the successful people that we looked at, they found a way to channel that discontent into something specific. They found a way to not just be discontented, but to use that as some kind of force for inspiration, as a force for action in their lives. And so it translated from this moment of just trying to live more, trying to do more, trying to be more something, and then found a way that said, okay, here's the expression of that, and here's what I'm going to do with my life that's going to be my quest or my adventure.
Getting into the idea of using the quest to find purpose in life, I mean, a quest is somewhat of a self-centered purpose, really.
Well, it can be or it can't be. You know, I don't think it has to be. And I guess, you know, first of all, let's say if you have a dream of your own, there's nothing wrong with following that dream. You know, there's a story I like of this guy from Portland, Maine, and his dream was to walk across the country. He just had this crazy idea, I'm going to walk across America. And he did that over 7.5 months. And that was just a personal project. You know, it was a personal self-discovery, you know, introspective kind of thing. He just had to prove it to himself that he could do it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, you know. But I also, when we set out to study people who had done this kind of stuff, we also looked at people whose quests were less self-serving, like what you mentioned with Scott Harrison and bringing clean water to the world. There's another story of a young woman in Tasmania, Australia. Her quest was inspired out of protest, and she wanted to protest illegal logging that was taking place on her island. And so instead of just writing a letter or instead of marching in the street or something, she went into the forest and climbed to the top of a tree and kind of made a campsite at the top of this eucalyptus tree and lived there for more than a year. And the whole time she was living there, she had a little mobile hotspot, and she was communicating with classrooms all over the world. She was teaching people about the environment. And so she was actually like forcing the loggers not to enter, you know, that space. So this entire action is not self-serving, but it's something that she was bothered by this, you know, action that was taking place, and she wanted to do something in response to it. So I think a quest can be a lot of different things.
Now, how did your quest begin to take shape? The idea of visiting every country in the world, was it something you documented in the book, people who are following those sort of life lists that they made at 16. There was one person who's basically, no substitutions, I'm going to do everything I said I was going to do at age 16. Right. Was this a childhood dream to visit every country in the world, or did it sort of take shape in your adult years?
For me, it definitely evolved as I went along. I didn't, it's not like I went to one country and said, oh, I want to go to every single other one, you know, from here. For me, I kind of had to work up to it. So after 9/11, I did a 4-year experience of living in West Africa. I went to volunteer for a medical charity there. I was just kind of, you know, disturbed and depressed like a lot of people were at that time. And I wanted to find a way to contribute to something. And so that was maybe my first experience of just being out in the world. And I went to about 15 countries as a part of that process. And the more I traveled, the more I liked traveling. And, you know, I was always making lists. I always like to make my to-do list and check things off. And so once I started traveling, I was making a list of all the places I had been to, all the different countries. You know, at a certain point, I had a goal to go to 100 countries. And so there's 192 countries in the world. And then my first goal was, okay, sometime before I die, you know, I want to go to 100 countries. And as I worked toward that goal, you know, I started realizing, well, maybe this goal isn't too challenging because I can just pick and choose which countries to go to. If it gets difficult somewhere, I'll just go somewhere else. So then I decided to increase the goal. Okay, let's go to every country in the world, no exceptions. And then every good goal has a deadline. So I chose my 35th birthday, which was last year. And that's what I've been working towards. So again, like your confidence expands through experience. I don't think everybody starts with this grand vision. I think as you do things that challenge you, as you do things that you enjoy, then you know, maybe over time you get more and more of a vision for something.
You write that for many of the people who do go on these quests, there's a defining moment. Can you describe that? What was the defining moment for you?
There's so many, but maybe one was, you know, after I'd been to, I don't know, 30 or 40 countries, and that's when I had the goal of going to 100. I was actually traveling through Southeast Asia, and I was on a ferry from Hong Kong to Macau. You know, this was like in the days before the internet was everywhere, and like you could get online, but it wasn't like you had, you know, access when mm-hmm. you're on the ferry. And so I spent a lot of time journaling and writing to myself, and that's when I was like, I wonder what it looks like, you know, to go to every country in the world, and like, how much would that cost? How much time would it take? What would be the likely obstacles? And I was really attracted to that kind of logical thinking. And so I remember just spending an hour just like sketching this out, and it really scared me. The idea, it just seemed totally ridiculous and absurd. But the more I thought about it, the more I couldn't get it out of my head. And finally, I realized, you know, at a certain point, I thought about this, you know, over a course of weeks and then months. I realized if I didn't pursue it, I would always regret it. And that's what finally tipped me to say, okay, I'm definitely going to do it. If I don't attempt this goal, like lots of things could go wrong along the way. I could have misadventures. I might fail, but that's different. You know, if I just don't attempt it, I'm always going to regret it. So that was the thing that tipped me.
And for many other of the people you profiled, it was a defining moment for Sandy Wheaton, who was let go from General Motors, who'd been making training films and training videos. She basically said, I'm going to travel every part of Route 66 and photograph everything along the way. Mm-hmm. For another photographer, it was making a million prints and having a million prints published, which sounds crazy, you know. So what was the defining moment for some of these folks?
For Sandy, it was when she was laid off. You know, she had been a career employee at General Motors. You know, she worked there for, I think, a decade or more, and she was laid off at the same time lots of her colleagues were, and they all kind of went into panic, and you know, there weren't a lot of jobs, you know, in the automotive industry at that time. And so all of her other colleagues were thinking, oh, no, what are we going to do? We have to update our resumes. We got to get our LinkedIn profile, you know, fixed. So we got to talk to our colleagues. And so she just kind of took a step back and said, well, you know, of course I want to take care of my situation, but I also want to use this as an opportunity. I want to use this as an opportunity to think about what I really want to do. And in her case, she did have this dream of traveling Route 66 and taking all these photographs. And she thought, if I don't do this now, when will I do it? And so she ended up, you know, pursuing that. And the interesting thing with Sandy is she created a whole new career out of the process, which she didn't know was going to happen. She started writing for magazines, and some of her photographs were getting published. And now she leads tours of the Maritimes. She's from Canada, so she keeps doing that while kind of spreading this message that she has. So none of this would have happened if she hadn't had said yes. You know, if she hadn't have said yes to adventure, if she just decided to go into the panic mode that all of her colleagues were going into. So in her case, maybe the best thing that ever happened to her was losing that good job.
Talk a little bit about the self-discovery you find as you're in the midst of doing this quest. Some of these quests that you write of are incredible athletic achievements. Like one gentleman ran 250 marathons in a year. Another cycling around the world, another walking across the United States. But for all of those major athletic competitions, there's others that are smaller. In fact, one here in Tulsa that you write quite a bit about, Sasha Martin, who cooked a meal from every country in the world. That sort of brought the world to her home, in a way.
Yeah, I love Sasha's story. I've been telling that all over America, and people really respond to that story. So Sasha there is a young mother who's now living in Oklahoma, but she grew up in Europe and some different places. And after she had a daughter, she wanted to show her daughter the world. But she wasn't able to travel. She wasn't able to take her young family to every country in the world. So Sasha, you know, thought about what she was good at, and she had a culinary arts degree. So she decided, as you said, to cook a meal from every country in the world. And so this became her quest. And she did it, you know, with no exceptions, no modifications, just like mine. And every week she would research the recipes, and she would create this, you know, really detailed meal, and she would play music from the country. So it wasn't just about food. It was also about culture, about people. Her daughter Ava is growing up, like, eating all this different food. And, you know, at 3.5 years old is, you know, equally comfortable with chopsticks or with silverware or with her fingers, you know, depending on what kind of food it is. And then Sasha started posting her recipes online. So there's a whole global community that's now engaging, you know, with this. So I love that story because there are people, like you said, who ran 250 marathons, you know, in a single year. And we hear that story and we think, like, wow, that's incredible. But, you know, I could never do that. Like, the average person is not going to go out tomorrow and the next week and run 7 marathons. But I think everyone can cultivate the value of adventure in their lives. And everyone can kind of look and say, okay, well, here's what I'm into. Maybe there's something that I've always wanted to do. Maybe I can't travel to every country in the world. I don't want to climb to the top of a tree in Australia and live there for a year, but there's something that I can do. And I too have this yearning to do something, and I can find it if I search for it.
Talk about Zha Zhang, who did this very interesting 100-day experiment. It's called rejection therapy, which you basically ask people for something until they say no, or ask a variety of people for a variety of things until they say no. And it's the art of, I guess, getting used to rejection. Explain what that was about.
Yeah, he has a crazy story. This guy, Zha Zhang, he's a Chinese-American young guy who had applied for a job, and he really was excited about this job, and he thought for sure he was going to get it, and then he was rejected. He got turned down, and he was troubled by not getting the job, but he was just as troubled by how disappointed he felt. And he thought, you know, this is just a normal disappointment in life. Like, we don't always get what we want. But he felt really uncomfortable. And so he decided to kind of challenge his whole idea of rejection. And so he created this 100-day experiment called rejection therapy, of being rejected as many times as possible for all kinds of crazy requests. And he decided to document this and put it up on YouTube. So he started with some really simple things. He would go up to a police officer and ask to like ride in their car. He'd go to the fire station and ask to, you know, to ride down the flagpole. He would go to restaurants and ask if he could cook his own food. He went to Krispy Kreme Donuts and asked if they could, you know, make a donut sculpture in the shape of the Olympic rings. So he started doing all these really crazy things. And the funny thing about it was some people said yes, you know. So some of the companies that he went to were like, oh, nobody's ever asked that before, you know, sure. So Krispy Kreme actually made that, you know, for him and gave it to him. And he posted that online. And so it was about, you know, kind of increasing your courage by doing different things. So it was just a fun little project. Like, again, probably anybody could have done this, but it just took a lot of courage and maybe creativity to think about all these different kind of things to ask people.
And yet he learned a lot about human nature when he did ask for what seemingly was outrageous things, and many times people would come through for him. And I think that's something that happens in most of these people's quests, is they learn something completely new about human nature and about their own resilience and abilities during the quest. What can you describe what your own process was of visiting all 193 countries? What did you learn about yourself as you were doing this?
Well, resilience is a good word. You know, I learned probably a few different things. I guess first thing is, I was a pretty anxious traveler when I started, and I loved to travel, but I always worried about a lot of stuff. And it wasn't that I wasn't worried about something bad happening to me. I worried I would screw something up. I worried I would mess up something in the planning process, or I'd get stuck somewhere and it would be my own fault. And the interesting thing with me is, like, I kept track of all the things that went wrong in 10 and a half years. And, you know, no doubt in all that travel, there were lots of things that went wrong and lots of mistakes that I made. And I called them misadventures. I kept this whole misadventure index. And I was interested to see that I actually had more misadventures toward the end of the journey than I did in the beginning. And I would have thought, you know, the opposite. I would have thought, like, you know, I'm getting better at travel. Like, I don't have to plan as much. You know, I can show up at the airport, you know, 30 minutes before my flight, jump on, everything's fine, you know. But I guess what I realized is in the beginning, I was double checking everything and triple checking things. I was really anxious. So by the time I got to the end, I had seen a lot of things go wrong. And yet I realized it was going to be okay. It was still fine, you know. Mm-hmm. So I guess the first thing is I gained a lot of confidence, just self-esteem and belief in myself that I could do something like that along the way. And the second thing would be that, you know, when I started doing this, I was just traveling independently. You know, I'm pretty introverted. I didn't spend a lot of time talking with people. But then along the way, at a certain point, I started writing about the journey. You know, I started this blog that a lot of people connect with. I started meeting my readers in different places and going around with them and getting kind of a local's perspective. And that was really, really good. And that changed the whole trajectory of the project to where, you know, by the time it ended, the focus was much more on community than it was on myself. So that was for the better as well, and I don't think I would have predicted that.
My guest today is Chris Guillebeau, an entrepreneur and best-selling author who visited every country in the world as part of a quest, and he's written about that and many other people's quests in the book The Happiness of Pursuit, Finding the Quest That Will Bring Purpose to Your Life. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. And it's a wide range of quests, everything from things that you can do in your own hometown to going around the world. Are quests for everybody?
I think adventure is for everyone.
Yeah.
And a quest can be anything. You know, I'm not interested in telling people, you know, how to live their lives or what they should do. What I can do is maybe teach from example and teach from all the different people I've studied. And all these people are different. You know, it's men and women of all ages, all backgrounds, all walks of life. And I really do think that pursuing adventure and doing hard things, whatever that looks like for each of us, is good for us. I do think challenge is good for us. I think it does bring purpose and happiness to our lives. And I think people find that in different ways, you know. And so it's really fun to kind of see people come alive and find their own quest, whether it's like Sasha's there in Oklahoma cooking a meal from every country in the world, you know, or something more active or something that involves travel or something that's humanitarian. So I do think a quest or an adventure is for everyone.
Now, you document a couple of people that at first glance might seem not so much like a quest, but in fact, the way you write about it does feel like a quest. One is a sushi maker named Yiro Ono, who lives in Tokyo, and I think he's been profiled now, so he's more known around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But he has this little sushi restaurant. There's no menu. He serves what he wants, but he's absolutely devoted to making the best sushi every day for his entire life. And there's another gentleman you write about, Howard Weaver, who basically was frustrated with the fact that his hometown newspaper wasn't covering the news he thought was important and sort of documenting the plight of the people in his city. So he wanted to create his own newspaper. Now, those don't sound like quests at first glance. Why are they quests?
The reason I liked the story of Hiro Ono is because he was so passionate about what he did. And he's so passionate about something that a lot of us couldn't care less about. You know, it's like, you know, who is super passionate about sushi to the point of like devoting their whole life to it? And he kind of came alive when he used a certain language. He would talk about, he would get a certain fish from the market and he was like, this is the best fish ever. You know, I'm just so excited about it. And so I kind of led to a principle that I wrote about, which is basically like, you have to believe in your dream, even if no one else does. And over when it comes to quests, I see people who are pursuing things that not everybody kind of gets or relates to. And in fact, this is kind of a sign that you found something because, you know, you're into this thing and maybe your friends don't understand. Maybe your family doesn't get it, but that's okay because it makes you come alive, right? Mm-hmm. There's that other story of a train enthusiast and he just loves trains so much. He's a train spotter and he travels to see all these different trains. And a lot of us would say, oh, well, it's a train, you know, but for him, it means something. And so I think, you know, when we find those kind of things, we should pay attention to them. So that's kind of why I wrote about Hiro's story and Howard's story of Howard's story was one of challenging an establishment newspaper. And Howard was this newspaper editor who felt that the big newspaper of the town wasn't really telling the whole story. It was really biased in favor of one party. And so his whole kind of thing was a mission, you know, in essence. It was a mission to kind of take down the other newspaper and, you know, provide a voice for the people, that kind of thing. And so a mission is very powerful. If you give people a mission, if people like buy into the mission, then it's something that you can really spend a lot of time and energy on if you believe in it.
Well, the other thing that's a part of this quest is there are going to be moments when you doubt yourself. I'm sure you at some point doubted yourself as you were trying to visit every country in the world. For the guy who's walking across the United States, it was probably a day or so into it.
Right,
as
right.
His feet are killing him, you know?
Yeah.
You know, at some point there's going to be doubt. How did you work through it, and how did some of these people work through it?
Well, I think you focus on why you're doing this. You ask yourself, like, what are the motivations? And hopefully you have some really good internal motivations. And, you know, if your motivations are external, if you're looking for validation or approval, then that's a little bit, you know, slippery because, you know, those things come and go. But if you have your own motivations, if you believe in, you know, why you set out to do this, then that can be very powerful. So I had lots of doubts along the way, lots of times that I wanted to kind of give up or something. And Nate, the guy who walked across America, same thing. But he told me this interesting story. He said, after a little while, I realized, you know, I my feet hurt, like you said. You know, it was raining. He had just broken up with his girlfriend right before we began the trip. And so that he's processing that whole emotional situation. So all these different challenges. But he realized that essentially, you know, all he had to do was walk. And it didn't really matter what else was happening, as long as he made literal progress every day, you know, one foot in front of the other, he would eventually achieve his goal. And so I liked that analogy because that's how I thought about going to every country in the world. It was the same kind of thing. It was like, as long as I make progress, I've got my list of countries, you know, as long as I'm going from one to the next, then eventually I'll make it. I'll achieve it.
And of course, during your, you were talking about your misadventures earlier, but it involved everything from being kicked out of a guest house in Mongolia, evicted, or to being deported from Eritrea, and yet that didn't daunt you at any point. And by the end of the journey, you began to roll with the punches.
Yeah, it was kind of fun, actually, after a while, because after a while I was thinking, well, this is, you know, like there's a certain monotony that sets in on any quest, and, you know, you never want to, like, go on this great radio show and say, oh, you know, visiting every country in the world was boring, because you know, most people don't get the chance to do that, right?
Right.
So, but because I always want to be honest with your listeners, I would say like that, you know, it's a 10 and a half year journey and there were points of monotony in it. There were points of kind of like, oh, this is kind of similar to what I've been doing, you know, in the previous 10 countries or something. So when something comes along that's a little disruptive, it can be kind of fun. It can be kind of interesting. It kind of makes me think, okay, well, I didn't expect this, you know, how am I going to respond and how am I going to adapt? And maybe even though this is a strange thing that I'm doing, like flying around the world all the time and going to all these countries, you know, for no other reason than to go to those countries. Maybe it's actually good that something's coming along to change that pattern because now it's going to help me, you know, think a little bit differently about the next one.
Along with being self-reliant is the idea that along the quest, that if something goes seriously wrong, that it's not self-reliance, it's being foolhardy. And you write about some people who, in fact, have had mishaps in their quest, and that's exactly sort of the public reaction. But when you go to a country like Somalia, or you know, a failed state for the most part, or North Korea, or Iran or Iraq, or these are places that are potentially hostile to Americans as a just a group. How did you negotiate those?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the list of those countries is pretty small. Like they do exist. I mean, there are failed states. I mean, all those countries that you mentioned. But out of 193 countries, we're really talking about a dozen, essentially, that are, you know, inherently dangerous. The vast majority are fine. There might be another group of countries that's a little bit dangerous, but, you know, I mean, something bad can happen to you anywhere, like in any country, even rich countries or perceived safe countries. So I guess when it came to that final group, you know, that dozen, I did try to be as safe as possible. In some cases, there was a creative solution. Like when I went to Iraq, I went to Kurdistan, which is part of Iraq, you know, geographically, politically, but it is essentially culturally its own state. It has its own government. It has its own currency in a lot of ways. It's its own country, but just because of how the world works, it's part of Iraq. So, you know, at the time, Baghdad was not really safe, but when I went to Kurdistan, I did feel safe. So there were situations like that where I tried to be creative and say, okay, how can I achieve the goal, you know, without putting myself at great risk? But overall, I feel like, you know, I don't feel like I took a lot of risks. I feel like I kind of evaluated the role of risk and thought, like, this is actually not super risky because of how I'm going to do it.
Now, one of the hardest things about it sounds like when the quest is over is processing what you learn and how you process this quest once it's over. And I think you quote one person said, people want to ask how I feel now that it's over, and it's like they want to hear a four-word answer, and I want to tell a novel. And so how did you process it, and how do these people process finishing a quest?
Yeah, I think in that story, she had just run this ultra marathon in the Sahara Desert, and you know, that was a 6-month process of the intensive training for that, and then the travel, and then, you know, a week or 10 days of running. You know, so she goes home, and people are like, "What's it like?" And you know, she doesn't have this short answer because it's complicated, and there's so much that's happened. But I guess you know, for me, what I learned is to focus on these stories and to focus and say, okay, well, like, I probably in the short conversation won't be able to tell you everything, but let me tell you this one moment, you know, let me tell you this one particular thing that happened when I was running in the desert, and here are the external circumstances, and then here's what I was thinking about internally, and like, you know, here's the takeaway. I think that helps, you know, it helps people to kind of connect with the moment. And then maybe more like personally, how do you deal with it? Well, you take some time and process for yourself, and you show gratitude for all the you know, great experiences that you've had, and then you look forward to the future, right? Because you've had all these great experiences, so what's next? Like, what are you going to do next? Because you probably can't stop. It's not like you're just going to go back to a life of routine after something like this.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting book, The Happiness of Pursuit, and whether you pursue a quest or you just change your life a little, there are great suggestions on how to bring more purpose to your life. Chris Guillebeau, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much, Chris. Thank you.
Chris Guillebeau is an entrepreneur, a best-selling author, and a quester who visited every country in the world prior to his 35th birthday. He's also the author of The Happiness of Pursuit, Finding the Quest That Will Bring Purpose to Your Life. It's published by Harmony Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.